Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. Today's podcast will be different from most, since we're not going to explore an individual building, but instead, we're going to explore the work done by the Heritage Resource Center, which is affiliated with the University of Waterloo. We're going to start by talking about what the center is probably best known for, which is their research, particularly the District's Works Study. But then we're also going to talk about another tool they have created called Building Stories. So let's get started. The District's Works research paper explores questions about heritage conservation districts in Ontario. This multi-phase study was done through the Architecture Conservancy of Ontario, who hired the Heritage Resource Center to carry out the groundwork and analysis. The project also used local volunteers to help collect the primary data, and in the end, there was a lot of data. The team examined 64 districts, which is about two-thirds of the current districts that exist in Ontario. They started with the oldest ones and worked their way up to newer ones. All the districts varied in size, from just a handful of properties to hundreds of properties. I will explain the methodologies next, but let's start by understanding the basics. For this, I spoke with Dr. Robert Shipley, who is a professor at the University of Waterloo and the director of the Heritage Resource Center. He holds a master's degree in planning, a PhD in planning, and a previous degree in history. I asked Dr. Shipley to explain how heritage conservation districts came to be and exactly what they are.
When people started the process of recognizing buildings and structures and bridges and other things as having historic significance, they were pretty well focused for a long time on individual properties. So this would have started in other countries with castles and cathedrals and grand houses. And in Canada, it was focused on mansions and churches and government buildings, post offices, that kind of thing. But over the years, people, I think, have realized that the more important level or focus of conservation is neighborhoods or areas or districts, so that it's not just the individual buildings, but the collection of buildings and how they form communities and spaces and communities in general. So a conservation district is an area that has been defined and recognized as having heritage significance, in which we want to practice some kind of change management. So change is always going to happen, but we try in districts to manage that change in a way that enhances the heritage and that doesn't compromise the historic values.
The process behind conservation districts comes into existence one of two ways. There's the top-down approach by which planning department staff or heritage committees identify an area that from their point of view has some heritage value, and then they decide to begin a process of recognizing that by putting some kind of regulation in place. The other is the bottom-up approach, where typically a few people in the neighborhood who feel very strongly about their area approach the city planners or the heritage committees with a request that their area be studied in order to get some recognition. Regardless of how a district comes into existence, there was very little research out there that examined them before the study came along. In fact, that was a huge part of the motivation behind the work, because there was just so many misconceptions being thrown around that were simply false. Research provides tangible information, concrete evidence that can help dispel some of these common myths. I spoke with Kayla Jonas Galvin, who is a heritage planner at the Resource Center and project manager for the Building Stories website. I asked her to explain how they went about their research, and here's what she had to say.
So we had several methods of data collection, and one of those was going into every single heritage conservation district that we studied and asking people what they thought about living in that district. So that was done two ways. One of them was working with local Architectural Conservancy of Ontario branches or municipal heritage committees, and using their volunteers to go out and knock on doors and ask people what they thought. And we at the Heritage Resources Center also did some of that work, knocking on doors as well.
When they would go door to door, they would ask a series of 12 questions. You can find the analysis and lists of questions online in their full form. However, for this podcast, I'm just going to look at four of their key findings surrounding questions that generally have the most misconceptions around them. 1. Have the goals of the district been met? 2. Are people content with living in a district? 3. Is it difficult to make alterations? 4. Have property values been impacted? So let's get started. Question 1. Are the goals of a district being met? Within a conservation district plan, there is generally an area that outlines specific goals for that district. In this part of the study, the team examined if those goals were being met. The short answer is yes. In varying degrees across districts, goals are being met. Some districts meet many of their goals, and some meet only one or two. But yes, they are meeting their goals. In fact, the research also showed that if goals were clearly articulated in the plan, the results tended to be higher.
Number two. Are people content with living in a district?
The results showed that people were overwhelmingly satisfied with living in a district. The study also examined their attitudes at the beginning of the district process and how they felt after having lived in a district for some time. Here's what they found.
When the designation process started, we found that there was maybe 40 or 50% of people in these districts who said that they were neutral, they were somewhat ambivalent, they didn't know what to expect. But how they feel about it now, we're talking about over 70% of people who were strongly in favor. So there was a real migration. People are happy once they see how it's working. And there are reasons for that.
As far as dissatisfaction goes, Dr. Shipley had this comment.
So we've probably interviewed something like 1,700 people as part of these studies. I think we found about 21 people out of 700 who are strongly opposed. And I don't think that any other matter of public policy, whether it's roundabouts or some public transit or any other issue, that would have that small a minority opposed. I think that this is a slam dunk. It should be for making decisions about what's good for a community when you've got such a tiny minority of people who are opposed.
Number three. Is it difficult to make alterations?
The study openly expresses that there was a lack of data, which means that no conclusive results can be found for this question. The lack of data is because there are many districts that just simply do not keep track of this specific information. However, Dr. Shipley did have this to say on the matter.
There's a sort of list of things that concern people about districts. And the purpose of our research was to answer those questions. People have legitimate questions. What is this going to mean to me and my enjoyment of my property? And that was one of them. How difficult is it to make changes? And so, as I've said, in the vast majority of changes that were asked for were approved. And the time that it takes to do that is, I would say, not onerous. It's not a long time. So somewhere between 1 and 4 months. To be clear, we're only talking about external changes, and external changes that are essentially visible from the street. So when people want to put an addition on the back of a house, usually there's no issue at all with that.
Number four. Have property values been impacted?
This particular question is generally the hot button issue and one that seems to always come up in conversations about districts without fail. It is about property values and the real estate performance of properties within districts. Now, many people believe that having a home designated will automatically mean that their property value will suffer, yet the findings from the study show the opposite is true. I asked Kayla to not only explain the results, but also explain to me the methodology behind how they were able to study this.
And we did that through a website called GeoWarehouse, and this is a real estate website that most real estate agents use, and it's based on actual sales values. So a lot of studies that have been done in the past about heritage property sales are based on assessment values, so what someone believes that the house is worth. So what we were doing is looking at actual sales values, what properties had actually sold for within the district. And we compared those with properties that were outside of the district within 1 kilometer. So it was a geographically based measurement to ensure that they were similar but not designated houses.
So what were your findings when you looked at property values?
So for when we looked at property values, we found that a lot of properties were selling at average or above average with their surrounding area. So the property values in Heritage Conservation Districts are very buoyant. They're doing quite well.
Well, this is just a snapshot of some of the findings from the District Work Study. However, as I mentioned before, the full analysis and data set is available online for all to read, use, and pass on. I will end with Dr. Shipley's advice to any community or individual who are thinking about districts or how they could possibly get started on the process of considering a district.
Well, I think they need to identify what it is that's valuable about the area. And one of the other things that the Heritage Resources Center has done is to develop a web system or a web-based system called Building Stories. And that anybody, it's a crowdsource system. So anybody can use this. So you can go on the site and you can put pictures of buildings and you can walk through the system that's there for identifying them. And so I think, first of all, people have to identify the components of the district they're talking about. And that is a tool we've tried to give to people.
This is the perfect segue into talking more about the Building Stories tool that was recently designed by the Heritage Resource Center. As Dr. Shipley mentioned, it's an online interactive site in which anyone can register in order to add a property. There are numerous pieces of information you can add, but at minimum, you need to know the address, municipality, common name, and if there's no common name, then you simply just put the address. You must have a photo and the ability to map it on a GPS. After that, any additional information is optional and encouraged. Once you put that up, other people can then add more information to it if they have it. There is also the optional architecture information you can submit. And even if you have no architectural background, the site has made it extremely user-friendly, creating visual icons to show architectural details. All you have to do is find the icon that is present on the building, and voila, you create an architectural description. There are currently over 1,300 properties on the site and over 300 active members. As I mentioned, any property can be added. It doesn't have to be formally recognized or specifically designated. You can put up structures, bridges, you could even put up a tree if you feel it's worthy. You can put in one building or an entire conservation district. Here's Kayla to explain a little bit more.
So you can add the Heritage Conservation District as a whole. So if it has a plan or a study that's been written, or you can add each of the individual buildings on their own and write about why each individual building is important. And this is particularly interesting for community groups that are thinking about doing all the research that goes into creating a background report for a Heritage Conservation District. You can use Building Stories to put in each building and build on that. People, as they find information, can add it in.
The Building Stories website has so many other features that you will just have to explore for yourself since we're running out of time. But there is a tutorial online, a frequently asked questions page, and of course, support is always just an email away. Oh, and I can't forget, one of the coolest parts, it's also an app, so be sure to download it. I will end today by letting Dr. Shipley add his final thoughts on the Building Stories website.
I think it's a perfect tool for communities to start to celebrate the specialness of their areas, and it's democratizing that identification. It's not just experts that are saying what's important about neighborhoods, but it's the people who actually live there.
Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast. I would like to thank Kayla Jonas-Galvin and Dr. Robert Shipley for taking the time to speak with me, and I would like to congratulate them on their success of their research and the Building Stories project. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you to the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Center at the University of Waterloo, the Center for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet at Building Stories, which is BLDG_stories. And of course, you can find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.